Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A new report finds most complaints about King County deputies did not result in any discipline. We'll find out why in a few minutes. First, our top story. President Trump is offending some allies at the NATO summit in Brussels. Trump said Germany is captive to Russia. Trump said alliance members are delinquent in their defense spending. Washington Congressman Rick Larson is on the House Armed Services Committee. He and 43 other Democrats have released a statement with an ominous last line, quote, "The future of the Atlantic Alliance and the international order, which has helped make the world safer and more prosperous, is at stake." Rick Larson joins us now. Welcome, Congressman.
Good afternoon.
President Trump has called NATO obsolete. The alliance is old. It was formed to defend against the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, which ended 27 years ago. How does the NATO alliance still help Americans today?
Sure. The NATO alliance, after the end of the Cold War, adapted to new security threats. The NATO alliance, for the first time ever, invoked its Article 5 commitments to defend a country, an alliance country that was attacked, and they did that after the attacks of 9/11. They've helped us. We've worked together with the alliance in Afghanistan, as a for instance. The NATO alliance has worked together in various other parts of the world, not just in Europe. And if you talk to alliance members who are currently border Russia, they will tell you that the alliance needs to be alive and well because they feel threatened by today's Russia. And I can confirm that as recently as last week. My senior military aide was over in the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and heard a very consistent message. The alliance is important. We need the alliance, and they need the United States to be a leader in the alliance.
And what exactly has Trump done that, as you say, puts the future of the alliance at stake?
Well, the way that President talks about the alliance, he makes it sound like it's been a it's more of a protection racket than anything else. He talks about dues payments where alliance members are delinquent on, and there's no such thing as a dues payment in the NATO alliance. They aren't delinquent. But in 2014, under President Obama, the NATO alliance agreed that all the countries would work towards and get to, by 2024, 2% of their GDP would be on defense spending.
So then, so you're right, President Obama called for that at a slower pace, but why? What's the big deal about Trump upping that pace for our allies to pay for more of a military force?
President Trump hasn't really, it's like the rooster waking up and in the morning and taking credit for the sunrise. The alliance members have been increasing their spending since the 2014 commitment, and they're keeping that commitment, and certainly we should always be pushing them to keep that commitment. But to attack alliance members more aggressively than you attack, say, North Korea, or you or attack Russia in terms of what Russia has been doing to interfere with domestic elections, not here just in the United States, but in our alliance partners as well, making it sound like our alliance partners are the enemy rather than Russia being the problem the alliance is trying to face. The president's just really off base on that.
I think I understand that frustration with Trump taking credit like the rooster with the belligerent words. But I'm not up on my foreign policy. What exactly has Trump done that, as you say, puts the future of the Atlantic Alliance at stake? What's the most concrete example?
Well, you noted it yourself, Bill, when you said the president has called the NATO alliance obsolete. We can hardly be a leader in the alliance when we're undermining its very existence.
Well, we certainly have gotten used to putting up with a lot of Trump words. What's the most concrete?
Well, yes, we have. I would agree with you that in the United States, we have put up with those words. But I would tell you that our alliance partners don't see it the same way. They're living next door to Russia, and we are not. And they have a much higher level of concern about what Russia is doing than the United States, through our president, is currently communicating.
And how does that concern put Americans, your constituents, at risk? The most specific example you could come up with would help.
Oh, sure. Well, my point on this is that we benefit from a NATO alliance as much as any country in Europe benefits from being in that alliance. We benefit from having the security that comes with having, in this case, 28 other countries who will stand beside the United States if the U.S. is attacked like we were in September 11th. We are not standing alone in the world. And when it comes to foreign policy or national security policy, that is very important. I can't tell you that for every dollar that an American puts in taxes towards the alliance, that they get a dollar of security back. But that's not how you measure national security. This isn't a trade relationship where we're getting an absolute or a good for the dollar we put in. The public good that we're getting is security, where we don't have to stand alone in the world, but we stand with partners.
In your statement, Congressman Larson, you said that Trump must, quote, stand up for Ukraine's sovereignty over Crimea and against the illegal occupation of Ukrainian territory.
Right.
What did President Obama do for Ukraine? What would President Hillary Clinton have done? What do you need Trump to do?
I need Trump, need the president to reverse his comments when he speaks with President Putin in Russia and tell Putin that the U.S. stands for an independent Ukraine, that we stand for helping Ukraine become a democracy and part of Europe.
And President Obama said those
things. And that we do not support its illegal annexation and invasion of Crimea, or do we stand in support of the Russian-supported occupation of the two eastern provinces in Ukraine. So the president's rhetoric is very important in this. You can compare it to Obama. That's fine. I live in today, and today we have a president who is undermining Ukraine's efforts to become a free and independent part of Europe.
And that's what I'm trying to find out. There was rhetoric, as you say, from President Obama, and I'm sure would be from if Hillary Clinton were president. And how does, you know more about this than I do, how do President Trump's actions concretely harm the case for Ukraine and Crimea?
It gives Russia the opening to further make its case that Crimea is part of Russia.
The opening to make its case.
Pardon me?
The opening to make its case.
It continues to give it the opening to make its case to the international community. If the United States recognizes that Crimea is part of Russia, then it opens the door for and it undermines anyone else's case that Crimea isn't part of Russia, that Crimea isn't part of Ukraine.
Yeah, that would be if President Trump recognized Crimea as part of Russia, which is he hasn't ruled that out.
And he hasn't ruled that out.
Yeah, that's right. So if the next president is the next U.S. president, if that person is as pro-NATO as past presidents have been for decades from both parties, do you think any damage will be reversed?
I'd hope that damage is reversed, but I can't predict that it will. I don't know what the response of the other 28 NATO countries would be in, say, 2021 to a new president. It really first depends on what a new president would say about the role of NATO. I would expect any new president to continue to push on the burden-sharing argument. The burden-sharing debate has been part of NATO as long as NATO has been around.
Mm-hmm.
But browbeating our allies while at the same time saying nice things about Putin, when Russia is really the target of NATO, undermines our role in NATO, undermines our leadership, and again it gets back to the sentence that you cited in this letter that we wrote. Really, it undermines the rules of the game, and those rules set up security. They stand for democracy. They push on human rights. And our president right now is taking actions and using rhetoric that is undermining our place in NATO. We're the United States of America. We should be the leaders here, and we're not leading.
Democratic Congressman Rick Larson represents the 2nd District, Island, San Juan Counties, part of Snohomish, Skagit, Whatcom, and serves on the House Armed Services Committee. And he signed on to this letter about being disappointed and more, very, very concerned about Trump's actions at the NATO summit in Brussels. And we'll watch what happens when President Trump meets with Vladimir Putin here next week, coming up in Helsinki. Thanks very much for this, Congressman Larson. Always good to talk with you.
Sure, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. We'll be back in just a moment. The Record continues on KUOW. A new report finds widespread problems and inconsistencies in the way the King County Sheriff's Office classified misconduct complaints. The analysis was released through the King County's Office of Law Enforcement Oversight. Out of 700 complaints filed in 2016, only a third of the complaints were investigated in a way that could result in formal discipline. And that includes some serious allegations like sexual assault or false arrest. KUOW's Carolyn Adolph reported on this story and joins us now. Welcome back, Carolyn.
Hello.
What's in this report?
Well, confirmation that the Office of Law Enforcement's spidey senses were right. Now, that office told a committee of King County Council yesterday that it saw something weird going on with the complaints that were reaching it. And so they got a Connecticut lawyer who's an expert in the field to look at the back end and see what was happening to the complaints process.
Okay, so it turns out that what was happening with the oversight office?
Okay, the oversight office was only finding out about the complaints that were deemed serious enough to go into the formal disciplinary process. But that was only about a third of the complaints. The other two-thirds were being shuffled off into some netherworlds called not about misconduct and minor misconduct handled by supervisor. Hmm. And those things were not getting any oversight at all.
Well, I suppose that could be an important distinction. What happens to a complaint when it is stamped not about misconduct?
Well, nothing happens. It sort of disappears as a disciplinary issue, which would be reasonable if all the complaints that landed there actually were investigated and were found to not really be about officer misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
But the officer found that he agreed, the author of this report found that he only agreed with about half the cases being labeled that way. And he found some serious allegations like sexual assault and violation of authority. And it seemed that many cases were not even given a serious review. They weren't given a cursory review. He observed that it seemed like sometimes the complainant was looked at and the case was just thrown out on the basis of how the complainant looked.
And what happened to the cases where officer misconduct was addressed by a supervisor?
Well, again, swept under the rug. Most of the time the author found that the investigation was incomplete. Often the police officer was never even spoken to about what their version of events. So there's, again, really a lack of proper process. And because all of these cases were handled informally, it couldn't form part of the progressive discipline process. That's super important because that was set up by union and management. And supervisors only get the power to fire if there's a file that says that there's been other incidents in the past.
Right. So it's got to be really, documentation.
Yeah, it's got to be documented. And this was informal. So, there's a lot of flaws in this that have been identified.
So what are the report's recommendations?
And start all over again. Create a new complaints process. And you're going to, you start with the idea that every complaint has to be formally investigated. And then classified as not really about misconduct or whatever, that you have to do some sort of an investigation. And the author said, even if the complainant doesn't want to be involved, or even if the sheriff's deputy doesn't want to talk to investigators, that shouldn't end the matter. That's not a way to stop things. There would be a large reform that would follow from that. It would really be like going to the very beginning.
And what does the King County Sheriff's Office say about this?
Well, all of this was based on data from 2016. This was the reign of John Urquhart. We have a new sheriff in town, quite literally.
Yes.
Yes, Mitzi Johanknik. And she, so she's put a new person in charge of the handling of complaints. And they are talking about starting the process of maybe moving the complaints investigators out of the office of the sheriff to improve their independence. So there's some movement, and the sheriff's chief of staff told King County committee members that it would be good to have more investigators. Liz Rocha told the committee of King County Council that part of the problem is there are only four in the sheriff's office who are investigating complaints. We're talking about 700 complaints in 2016 alone. You know, Oakland's got a similar size force, and they have 13 investigators.
Okay, so finally, Carolyn, what happens now?
Well, maybe nothing. So a lot has to be to change in order to really integrate these recommendations. And it starts at the sheriff's office, and then it moves to the sheriff's office's negotiations with the police guild. So there's a lot of things that would have to change. And so far, the record's not good. Voters may remember that that King County voters voted years ago to give the Oversight Office its own independent investigatory powers. But those haven't materialized yet because they're still all wrapped up with negotiations with the police guild. So one thing people can do is call 206-296-0100, sorry. And
296-0100.
Thank you. Spoken like a person who can speak. and asking to direct a comment to the sheriff. Or they can Google the sheriff's office. There are plenty of emails there where the people can use to make their views known.
KUOW's Carolyn Adolph looking into a report that the King County Sheriff's Office has been wrongly categorizing many misconduct complaints against officers, ones that should have warranted more investigation. Carolyn, thanks again.
Thank you.
KUOW's The Record, battle tactics for your sexist workplace, even if that workplace is the highest bench in the land. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. When the U.S. Senate considers President Trump's new Supreme Court justice nominee, they will debate the ways Brett Kavanaugh might change the shape of the court for decades to come. I wonder whether they'll consider how the justices treat one another. On KUOW's new podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, the hosts played audio from the Supreme Court bench of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg being interrupted.
Well, suppose there were three unrelated cases.
Pardon?
Suppose there were three unrelated cases, but the statute...
To be clear, that was Anthony Kennedy interrupting the notorious RBG during oral arguments at the Supreme Court. And you might not have even heard Justice Ginsburg there because she barely got a chance to talk.
I inadvertently interrupted Justice Ginsburg, but in the 19 cases here... You don't
find
that?
Did he just say he interrupted her and then he kept talking anyway?
Yes.
Yes, he did. Those KOW hosts are Jeannie Yandel and Eula Scott Bino. Welcome back.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
So for your podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, why did you take it all the way up to the highest court in the land?
Because it was documented and it was easy to find. Really.
Yes.
And accessible.
This yes.
Most of us don't have microphones in our workspaces.
That's mm-hmm. true. That's true. And it was also sort of, even the professor from Northwestern University who did the study on interruption, she wasn't necessarily intending to do that study, but she kept hearing it happen. And she said it was, you know, it made her angrier than when she's interrupted. So that's why she decided to look at it.
There have been two women added to the court in the last decade. Has that changed the interruption rate?
Nope.
No, they're still interrupting.
No, nope.
Why is that?
At a rate of 3-1.
Do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly why. I could sure speculate, but I don't know exactly why. But it's, you know, one of the things that we learned in making the episode, and we're not trying to say it's the women justices' fault, but there is a thing that has been studied called the female register, right? And that happens, women will tend to upspeak, so turn a statement into a question or kind of couch what they're going to say, like, I'm sorry, this might be totally off base. I just might be crazy, but, you know, disregard it if I'm wrong. And I'm not saying that any of the women justices do this, but the professor who did the study noticed that it tended to happen when they got on the court, and then it dissipated over time.
You noted in your podcast that in the wider world, if I got this right, that women also interrupt women at a higher rate than I don't know, than you might expect. It's not just going one way. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think that so everyone can be interrupted and can be an interrupter. But I think the big difference there is that often when women are interrupting, they're what I believe to happen, what I've witnessed myself, is to build on something.
Yes.
So if Jeannie's talking and she's making a point or she's elaborating something, but I'm kind of missing some detail, I might interrupt and say, wait, so where did you say you were parking? Oh, okay. I remember where we're, so keep going.
Yes.
Which is very different than the way, you know, the justice just interrupted Ruthie and just by purely interrupting and steering the conversation where he wanted to lead it without going back and checking in with her.
Yeah. And there's research to back up what you observe as well, Eula. There's a linguist named Deborah Tannen, who we talked to in the episode, who said that in her decades of research of how we communicate, when women interrupt in general, we interrupt each other to build on an idea, not to steer the conversation in a different direction.
Or to be dismissive.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's interruption and there's interruption.
Yes.
You mentioned that most of us don't have microphones in our workplaces. We do have. I do have a microphone in my workplace.
It's funny you should bring this up.
Yeah. First of all, we radio hosts interrupt people for a living sometimes, right? Is that, should we feel bad about that? Or are we doing it wrong?
Well,
am I doing it wrong?
I mean, you know, conversation and interviews are not the same thing,
yeah.
Which you know,
yeah.
You know, and meetings and interviews on the radio are not the same thing. But, you know, it's never a bad thing to ask yourself why you're interrupting a person. And if you're interrupting a person because it's a live radio interview and you need to, you know, you need to hit a post, you need to like finish an interview.
Mm-hmm.
Then you should probably interrupt the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Or if they're saying wildly crazy things that are inappropriate, you should totally interrupt.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
What about in meetings? You've worked with me, especially you, Jeannie. Am I a man-interrupter? And you can be, I want you to be honest.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yes, you are.
I'm sorry. As I believe you. And tell me, what do you think is going on there?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different things going on. And that's one of the things we learned in the episode is it's really difficult to just say, this is what's happening. This is the single cause. Here's the single thing you can do to change it.
Right.
You know, but you're in a meeting. The meetings we have in the morning have a time limit and then we have to move on to other things. And so, you know, sometimes you're jumping in because you want to get to the point. Sometimes you're jumping in because you're really excited about an idea. Sometimes you're jumping in because you don't understand what somebody else is saying, so you want to ask a bunch of questions. This is what I've observed working with you over the last 15 years.
Yeah, that's all.
You know, but the question you have to ask yourself when you're doing that is am I going to get what I want by interrupting in this way? Am I going to get the right answer? Am I going to move things along? Am I going to make sure that this idea is as strong as it is by interrupting right in this moment?
Mm. And then another part of it too is I'm an interrupter. Like as a woman, I'm an interrupter. I know I'm that way. I get really like excited about conversation and I tend to jump in or jump ahead sometimes. And I've had to kind of really sit back and think about how it's affecting the person who I'm interrupting, right? Because they had something that they were trying to say too. And by me interrupting and steering the conversation in the direction that I like know is going to be so much fun to go in, I'm still not allowing that person to get their point across, which is really important for them to feel, you know, a connection to the conversation and feel heard and valued too.
Well, before we leave me aside, I did ask whether I was a man-interrupter. So I'm also asking, do you think I interrupt women more than men?
I don't think that that being a man-interrupter means you have to do women more than men.
Oh, okay.
I think it just means that like there's something, I think men probably tend to do it more to women because we tend to come into spaces very much more, you know, aware of how we might be treated were we to speak differently. Right?
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. It's more interesting than just you're being sexist in this moment.
Yes.
Although that may be true as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's a function to the word man-interruption, right? Like it's sort of helpful in that it communicates a certain thing, but that doesn't mean you can just be one thing. There are facets of interruption. Right?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
There's the chip in. There's the, you know, there's an addition. There's a say more about that. I think you've got more to say.
Yeah.
There's nuances.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I will answer your question directly. If you want to know if you are or ever have been a man-interrupter, I would say yes sometimes.
Yeah. That's fair. That sounds about right. Sorry.
It's okay.
But one of the tactics.
What is it?
One of the tactics that I was thinking too about, even just your guys' mindset of having these early morning meetings, and if you have an idea like that, Bill, and you really want to join in and be more, you know, contribute more, but you don't know exactly how to, you know, shift manterrupter versus contributor, you could just kind of make sure you're on the agenda every morning with something that you want to say, so that it's already pre-planned, that you have a moment where like the thing that you really want to get out gets out.
Yes.
And so it doesn't have to feel like, oh, I have to get this out, so I have to stop everyone else's conversation. It's okay, cool, I'm on the agenda second, so I get to get my idea out second. I'm just gonna be patient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can also write down your questions. It's not like, you know, you don't have conversations later, and, you know, bring those questions up later.
Yeah. You said that part of the problem with meeting culture, again, the podcast is Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, and one of the problems with meeting culture, you point out, is that it privileges people who are comfortable speaking up and maybe interrupting or being interrupted. And we were talking about it this morning at one of our meetings, and one of our producers, Amina, said she used to be terrified of speaking up in meetings and being interrupted, but she's glad she learned how to navigate those things. Sometimes she was pushed into learning, and she thinks there's a fair question here. Should we be when should we be accommodating of shy, quiet people? When should we not be, you know, when should we not be accommodating of that trait?
I mean, if we're talking about meeting culture, right? And if the goal of a meeting is to hear all ideas and to discuss all ideas, I would say you do need to be accommodating of people who aren't sort of naturally comfortable in that environment. If you actually want to hear everybody's ideas, you need to make sure everybody has a chance to speak uninterrupted. Otherwise, you're not really hearing all the ideas. You're just hearing the people who want to talk the most. You're hearing those ideas.
And also, why are they at the meeting, right? If they're being delegated a task and that's the purpose of the meeting, then that's, like, you know, very different than a collaborative meeting meant to build ideas upon.
Right.
Because if a person doesn't get a chance to join in, I would hope that at the end of the meeting, I would say, Jeannie, I haven't heard from you. You know, the reason why I invited you here was to hear from you, girl.
Yeah.
But because I wouldn't invite you to the next meeting. I'd be like, Jeannie, don't talk. But if I had tasks for you, I also would just slack them to you later. Like, you don't have to come sit in on this whole meeting for me to tell you later to, you know, staple everything together.
Yeah, that's a good point. We love meetings, but you have to be clear on what the goal of the meeting is. And sometimes that means making sure everybody gets to talk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Slack. That's for those who don't know, it's a workplace communication tool. That's a place where you get to say everything you're going to say because you're the one typing. I wonder if Slack and other, you know, online media or computer media are changing what we expect about being heard.
I bet it's a good tactic for those who are shy and feel uncomfortable really speaking up in meetings.
Yeah.
I bet you that it's really allowed for them to contribute differently.
Yeah. It also helps for people who work remotely. You know, I mean, the idea of everybody being in the same physical space is, you know, that's not necessarily the norm anymore. But also, I mean, where do you make your decisions? If you make decisions in meetings, then you have to think about how everybody exists in those meetings and who gets to talk and who doesn't. If you make decisions on Slack, sweet. That's great. You know, that means everybody can chime in, and maybe the person who's got the best, you know, the best GIF game wins. Who knows?
Right. I'm too old to be a digital native. Do you think that younger workers have more of an expectation of a writing, Slack, texting, you know, Facebooking culture where they type everything they want to say, and then they go to a meeting and they're not used to you know, we hear about young people don't like to have telephone calls, and are meetings harder for younger people when it comes to interrupting? That's a general question, but I wonder.
I mean, there's certainly, you know, all I can talk about is my own observation and what other people have told me and researchers, but, you know, there are power dynamics in meetings too. So, you know, if you think about the people who traditionally have the most power in a room where there's a meeting, it's not the youngest people in the room, you know, so they might be more comfortable talking through ideas in a place where they don't have to sort of compete for vocal space, you know, where, you know, they're not dealing with somebody who has more power than them, who signs their paycheck, who decides if they get promoted.
Eula Scott-Bino and Jeannie Yandel, host of Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, and the latest episode takes up interrupting. And manterrupting in some cases. Eula, you mentioned that a strategy is to put what you want to say on the agenda. We talked about writing a question down. What could I do if I want to be less of an interrupter of the bad kind, but in the moment I think the meeting's running long. I think what I have to say is going to be a valuable addition at that moment for every lucky person in the room who gets to hear my voice. Yes. In the moment, what could I do?
Are you me?
oh, yeah, it's you and me?
It totally is me. Okay. But what I've learned is what I have to say often can still be said to the person that I really, really needed to hear it before the day is done, you know? Which is not as much fun as a whole room laughing at the joke, but I can totally eventually just walk over to Jeannie and be like what I was going to say 4 hours ago, which was really funny. But it didn't prioritize me over the work that needed to be done in the part and the team that I needed to support.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you can also woe Nelly yourself. You can check yourself before you might think, but just do a little check. Is this really so? Is this really so? Before you speak up.
Yeah. And the check is kind of, you know, is this required to be said right now? Would it add to the conversation? Would it make a difference? Would it, as you know, or is it necessary?
Right. Or am I totally confused and need clarity?
And yeah. Do I just want to be funny?
Yeah. That's another aspect of interrupting. Sometimes that back and forth is going to be so funny for everyone.
Yeah. But then on the other end, that person might be like, dang it, Eula again, you know, did not allow for me to tell her that I cannot get to the bathroom without the key that she took from me 6 hours ago. And I, you know, this person needs to be heard too.
It's funny we brought up the idea of Woe Nelly, because I've just been telling people about this helpful thing I read about mindfulness, that's because I have trouble not taking the candy from the candy dish at the workplace. And I try to stop myself, but this thing I was reading was saying, think of it not as something you have to stop yourself from doing, but just think of it as an urge that's going to pass. You have lots of urges. They come, they go like waves. And that has been so great for me.
That's really good.
Yep.
Because when it comes to interrupting, I just think, I don't really have to say this right now.
Yeah.
If it's important.
Yes, yes, interrupting and candy. I'm excited about using that on candy because I have a similar problem. I literally stopped at the candy dish and said no out loud to myself and kept going, and that's a bummer.
Yeah.
No, that's beautiful.
So we have a couple minutes left. Can we really fix this? This is a cultural thing. We're talking about interrupting in the workplace. Is this something we can fix by asking people to police themselves?
I think it's hard to say to someone, you're an interrupter, can you police yourself? Because I think that the first reaction for most people would be to get defensive and then to shut down and to probably not really like really all the way hear what's going on. I think the best thing about battle tactics for your sexist workplace is that you can send these episodes to people just, you know, in a really simple text. And that's a really nice way to say, I want us to all be expanding our abilities in the workplace to see each other, to hear each other, to be better coworkers. Listen to this episode. And they're probably just going to start mentally checking their interruptions anyways, right?
Yes.
So I wouldn't necessarily call them out and say, hey, you're like a man interrupter and I just need you to get it together. Because they might be like, girl, you're fired.
Right.
Yeah. But what's a better option is probably saying, oh, I'm really enjoying this new podcast. You should check out this episode.
Yeah. And one of the nice things about the problem of interruption is if people decide they want to become more conscientious or mindful of it, that is a way to make things better. Not every problem we face can merely be fixed by people becoming more mindful. But this can go a long way here.
Mm-hmm. And I think you can casually say too, I'm really enjoying this episode about man interruption. I learned this really cool stuff. And then if your coworker is as nice as you are, Bill, to be like, well, am I a man interrupter? Be honest.
Mm-hmm. Right?
You want to be honest.
They're asking the question.
Yeah. And I know that was hard for you, probably, Jeannie, to say like,
it was a little awkward, but I was happy to do it.
I bet you your relationship will be better and your workplace interactions will bloom in all kinds of ways, even after 15 years, right? Mm-hmm.
Eula Scott Bino, Jeannie Yandel, mostly not interrupting each other here today about the latest episode of KOW's new podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, which you can hear with all the others wherever you get your podcasts. And you're on social media.
Yeah, yes, and you guys can come see us tonight, actually.
Yes.
We're having like a tactical meeting or a boot camp this evening at
The Riveter on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. I just interrupted you. It's 7 o'clock.
No, I appreciate you.
A tactical meeting at the Riveter tonight, 7 o'clock. Eula Scott Bino, Jeannie Yandel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye, y'all.
Back with more of The Record in just a moment. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Have you ever been walking through the woods and heard a sound you didn't recognize? It's not quite human, but it's close. Could that be? I mean, I'm alone. I'm getting nervous. Could that be the hairy, upright, walking, almost ape-like creature said to roam the North American wilderness? No, no, Sasquatch isn't real. Or could it be? What if we took a curious approach to that question? My next guests have a scientific approach. They've both written field guides for the citizen scientist looking to collect evidence of Bigfoot's existence. Jeff Meldrum, professor of anatomy and anthropology from Idaho State University. Welcome, professor.
Thank you.
That's Jeff. And David George Gordon is in the studio with me, a science communicator, the author of the Sasquatch Seekers Field Manual. Hi, David.
Hey, it's good to be here.
And you two, David and Jeff, have met, but not like this. You've talked online.
Only through cyberspace.
Yes.
That's right. That's right.
So first, and it's going to get more interesting, but first, in one word, yes, no, or maybe, is Sasquatch real? David?
I'm going to go with a maybe.
Maybe. Jeff?
I'm quite convinced that it is, yes.
Okay. A yes and a maybe. And in any case, we're going to approach it with curiosity and a scientific mindset. Jeff, you said probably yes. What evidence do you have of Sasquatch's existence?
Well, evidence comes in a variety of different forms. My particular expertise, what actually drew me into the pursuit of this question, was the footprint evidence. That's how I spend much of my time, is studying the evolution of human bipedalism. And so the prospect of another bipedal primate out there leaving a trace record of footprints has been a very, very intriguing one for me.
David, you are more skeptical, not as skeptical as I am, but more so, what do you say about
evidence? I actually mentioned in my book that I'm a fence sitter. I say, there's something out there. I don't want to say it doesn't exist. Someone could find one tomorrow and I'd be wrong. But I also don't want to go to court with the evidence we've gathered, because a lot of it has holes in it.
So it's almost a philosophical approach to what it means to say yes or no. Obviously, something could exist.
Yeah, and you know, my contention is we need more evidence. I mean, the footprints, those are pretty convincing, but about at least a half of them have been ruled out as obvious fakes, including the one that spawned the name Bigfoot.
That's an obvious fake?
There was a deathbed confession on that one.
Jeff, do you believe that? Obvious fakes?
No, I'm afraid I have to disagree with David. He has a few of his facts a little misconstrued, I'm afraid, and a bit of hyperbole. I have over 300 footprint casts in my laboratory here, and if I was pressed to come up with a statistic, I would say less than 5% of them are obvious hoaxes. A few more may be somewhat ambiguous or questionable due to the lack of clarity or insufficient documentation. But the footprint evidence is extremely compelling. And the example that David points out is one that has gotten far too much mileage for the lack of substance that's there. A gentleman's family claims that he faked a bunch of footprints and trod out a couple of extremely crude carved wooden feet and assert that all the footprints that have been found in North America are attributable to the Wallace clan.
What about that, David? You said yourself that some fakes don't mean all fakes, so why the big skepticism when Jeff is saying he's got some footprints worth looking at?
Well, again, I have seen ones that have what are called dermal ridges or equivalent of fingerprints on the foot. I've seen ones that show really great sophisticated degrees of flexion that you could not fake by carving something out of plywood, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's something out there for sure. In fact, I hear what I really put more stock on is the eyewitness testimony. And quite frankly, there's not a real lot of percentage in telling stories when you've got nothing to gain. You're not trying to get on TV or sell a best-selling book, but you actually stand a lot to lose in terms of ridicule and things like that. So I take those seriously.
Interesting. I would have thought that a eyewitness account without any physical evidence is easier to discount. Sure, people say a lot of things.
Well, I kind of agree with you on that, but I also know a lot of people who have these sightings are experienced outdoors people or hunters, are not likely to mistake this thing that they saw for a bear or an elk or some other large mammal.
Have you found that, Jeff? Reliable people?
I, Yes, I would echo that. That, you know, when the category of eyewitness is a very broad one, and it includes people who are overly enthusiastic and may overinterpret what they've seen. They may see what they want to see, but then there's a significant fraction, as David points out, that are objective, level-headed professionals who spend their lives in or a large part of it in the out of doors, and you know, they know the difference between a moose or a bear and an upright bipedal hominoid that defies attribution to any common form of wildlife.
David, what are common kinds of stories people tell you about encountering Sasquatch?
You know, I just want to build a little bit on this. I give talks through Humanities Washington on this topic.
Yes.
And oftentimes there are like four or five people in the audience who have first-person experiences. Now, some of those people you can tell, gee, they've told this story before. It's become their family thing. And I kind of question those. But on the other hand, there are people who are like, I've never really spoken about this before. It's like I've created a safe environment, like an AA meeting or something. And the people who do tell these stories, they have some recurring themes. Oftentimes they have rocks thrown at them, but not rocks that are thrown in a way that would hit them, because you'd certainly think a Sasquatch could do that, but just sort of as warning shots, if you will.
They see the beast throwing rocks at them?
Or they see a rock that landed in an area where there were no people to be throwing them.
I see.
So that's a common theme. A lot of them are, I was driving late at night. I went around a bend. They're like instant recognitions. Mm-hmm. Although I got to say, it's amazing how much you can take in, you know, a 3-second glance from a speeding car. You would definitely know what you were seeing from that.
Is there an emotional theme to the stories people tell you?
Well, I also hear a lot of stories, kind of surprising to me, that are like the Sasquatch as a mind reader or an empath, if you will. You know, people say, I was sitting in the back of my pickup truck and I was really sad because my mom had just passed away. I was out in the woods and then this thing came out of the woods. I've heard that on several occasions. So it's almost like they are you know, responding to this call for help.
What about you, Jeff? Are there emotional themes in what people tell you about Bigfoot?
Well, it often is a very life-changing experience, and I think it shocks people, the realization that there really could be things out here that they've been told don't exist. You know, there is this, as David alludes to, this paranormal dimension that many, many people have gotten kind of caught up in. I think some of that comes from their own lack of ability to come to an objective position where they, understand since we're talking about citizen scientists, a scientific context for the possible existence of such a creature. And so they resort to other forms of explanation. I know, you know, a lot of people have shared such subjective experiences with me. I've not shared them with them in the field. They seem to be to vanish when I'm on the scene. So that's an area, unfortunately, I think is more distraction than helpful in this situation.
Well, what's wrong with me that emotional component, while I find it lovely in the bigger picture, it makes me more skeptical about Bigfoot stories because, yeah, we're not objective. We're humans. That's okay, but there's no Bigfoot.
You know, I really believe we just need more and better quality evidence. That's where the citizen science comes in. Getting people who are actually trained, let's say they went to a weekend retreat in data gathering and collection, and then they can hand that over to people like Jeff Meldrum and actually have that analyzed rather than all these people who are out there kind of with half-baked assertions and not knowing what to do with them.
Okay, well, then let's talk about data collection. Again, that was David George Gordon, a science communicator, author of the Sasquatch Seeker's Field Manual. And we have Jeff Deldrum, a professor of anatomy and anthropology from Idaho State University. And Jeff is more inclined to think that there is a Bigfoot, Sasquatch, or something like it. I want to, whether I believe or don't, or I don't know, I'm curious and I want to collect data one way or the other. What would I, let's start with you, David, what could I, people listening to you, do out in the wild?
Well, first thing is be prepared to write things down. You know, if you have a, if you're in an automobile accident, your insurance company says, as soon as it's safe, write down all the details.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say the same thing. You're not going to reach for your pad when you're staring at this 10-foot tall creature in the middle of nowhere. But as soon as you have a moment to breathe, I would definitely start writing that down.
That starts with me bringing a pad because I've got my headlamps, I've got my propane. I don't usually bring a pad.
Yeah, that's right. People have kind of lost the ability to write these days, which is unfortunate. A lot of what we know about the Northwest comes from like the logs or journals of naturalists from way back when. Lewis and Clark tell us a lot. Those guys did not have all these distractions that we have. They're not working on their smartphone at the same time. And getting that detail is really important because the thing that's funny, as you tell the story, the more you tell it, certain things become exaggerated. It's like that fish story. How big was it? You know, and the more you tell that story, the bigger those things get. And some other things really important. Well, did you hear any other noises? Was it silent? What was the weather like? A lot of that kind of those details drop out. So really writing all of that down is number one on my book.
Why does it matter what the weather was like?
There might be able, you know, over time, we might be able to see trends. It, you know, a lot of those sightings happen, for example, during a foggy day. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know because I haven't really analyzed.
And what do you know? The sightings are on foggy days and Bigfoot is blurry. Maybe there's a connection.
Or whatever. We can see trends from that. And, you know, with there are thousands of eyewitness reports. And actually, from my giving these talks and realizing how few people actually fill out reports and file them on the Bigfoot Research Organization's website or what have you, that's a, you know, the tip of the iceberg, actually. But how much of that detail is actually captured and shared, that's another story.
Jeff, what else about how we can contribute to this this question, this mystery?
Right. Oh, and I would just add in follow-up, too, even though people may not be inclined to grab a notepad and a pen and take along with, you know, David mentioned the smartphone. There are very few people out there now that don't have a smartphone in their back pocket. You just have to hit the record button, and you can narrate your experience and log the details down and be that much more certain to get some of those details recorded.
That's true. I have a zipper pocket in my backpack for the smartphone, which is useless when there's no service in the wild, except, I could do a voice memo. Right. I can type on that thing. Keep
it around. I'm reaching for my little notepad, waterproof notepad.
He's holding it up. Wait a minute. Can I see that?
Can I see that?
It has a picture of, it says coffee for Sasquatch, and it has a picture for Sasquatch. Why coffee for Sasquatch?
That's a shop in Los Angeles.
Ah, got it.
Just had to save that.
And it's a waterproof notebook. Very nice. It's very small. That goes in a breast pocket.
That's right. It has a sticker from a florist shop in Italy, too.
I see that. Yes, Jeff?
Well, one of the points that is important to bear in mind that I remind people of is that if indeed these creatures exist, I'm quite convinced that they're extremely rare. It's a very dispersed population. It doesn't need a lot of individuals to sustain it because of various inferences we can draw about their natural history. Since they, if they exist, they're large hominoids. So that means they're long-lived. They have no, given their size, no natural predators, etc. There just doesn't have to be very many. And given what seems to be solitary behavior and far-ranging home ranges, large home ranges, the opportunity to encounter Sasquatch is very serendipitous in many ways. So I tell people to become familiar with the areas that they frequent. Learn about the natural history. Learn about the geology, the forest types, the plants, where the cover and the food are. Learn more about the behavior of the other wildlife that's there. So you have a context while you're out there searching and looking, and above all, enjoy the time that you spend out there, because chances are you're not going to have an encounter. You're not going to experience quote-unquote Sasquatch activity every weekend that you go out into the field.
When you say there may just not be very many, Jeff, how many are you thinking? How many Sasquatches do you think there are?
Well, if I had to put a number in, in North America, I would say it would be under 2,000.
Under 2,000.
Yeah.
Wouldn't we at least find? I know that Sasquatches, they run away and all that. They're elusive. But what about just finding dead Sasquatches? If they're thousands, well, eventually we come across one.
Well, let's put that in context. Here, I'm from Idaho, and so if I sort of crunch the numbers without belaboring with you here how I arrive at that formulation, but I would estimate of those 2,000, there's about 100 to 150 Sasquatch in Idaho, just as a working number. By comparison, there's 25 to 30,000 black bear in Idaho. And yet, you know, if you started talking to outdoorsmen, how many outdoorsmen have bumped into a carcass of a bear?
Yeah, good point.
In the wild. So when you start thinking about the implications of those numbers as far as the accumulation of data, the chances of encountering a Sasquatch or finding trace evidence of it, then you start to really appreciate how rare an event this is. And so as a scientist, that's a little bit frustrating and discouraging because it means I can't go out in the field and consistently, in a systematic way, collect data about Sasquatch. And so I'm very beholden to, I rely upon those quote-unquote amateurs, or those, better yet, those citizen scientists who have trained themselves, who have developed some skills in the field, to collect and document and discriminate and identify and report that data to me.
Jeff Meldrum, professor of anatomy and anthropology from Idaho State University, on the phone with us. David George Gordon is in the studio, author of the Sasquatch Seekers Field Manual. And David, you're going to be giving a talk about cryptids and Sasquatch on July 28th in Moses Lake.
There's a wonderful exhibit of Sasquatch abelia at the Moses Lake Museum and Art Center. Just opened quite recently.
All right.
I understand Jeff Meldrum is speaking there as well.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
July 28th.
In August.
And that's in August. And
I'll be there in August.
Good. And also, David, you're August 8th. You're at the San Juan Library, and you're just around Washington this fall with Humanities Washington.
I would say go to the Humanities Washington website. They actually got so many requests for my talk that they kind of turned off the tap.
And, I believe it.
Now people are basically forking over their own cash to get me out there.
And you heard them for free on KUOW. David and Jeff, thanks very much to both of you.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for tuning into The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Lars, Matt Martin, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. See us live tomorrow night. We're talking Joni Balter, Chris Vance, Nikita Oliver, reviewing the week's news on stage with you at the McMenamins Anderson School in Bothell. Doors open for you at 6 p.m. Tickets are free. Just go reserve your seat at kuow.org/engage, and we'll see you tomorrow night.